Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm Donna Loring. Today's program is a little different. I want to invite you into the room with me for my Robert Talbert keynote lecture, a talk that looks at Maine's history through the lens of truth-telling, paper chains, and the resilience of our people. It's part a history lesson, part personal reflection, and part call to action. I'm grateful to share it with you on air.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight, and welcome to Buchanan Alumni House. My name is Tom Pico, and I am the President and CEO for the University of Maine Alumni Association. Welcome to the fifth annual, hard to believe, fifth annual Robert Talbert Civil Rights Speaker Series. This series was founded in 2021 in partnership with the Greater Bangor Area Branch of the NAACP. Created to promote dialogue and engagement around human equality, encouraging all of us to be open to learning and ideas from a variety of perspectives. This series, as you know, is named in honor of Robert Talbert. Bob is a Bangor native who attended the University of Maine and who for decades has been one of Maine's foremost leaders in the pursuit of racial equality and justice. You can read more about Bob's incredible lifetime of service to civil rights in Maine in your program. So as I just mentioned, this event started in 2021 under the leadership of two visionary individuals who are with us this evening. Pleased to introduce you to Michael Alpert, who is the past president of the Greater Bangor Area Branch of the NAACP, who co-chaired this event. And John Diamond, who you will hear from in just a couple of minutes, who is still remains event co-chair and is our president emeritus for the University of Maine Alumni Association. Thank you for being here. We do have several other distinguished guests that I would like to recognize at this time. I know that State Representative Lori Osher is with us tonight, so thank you for being here. We have Hannah Hudson from the University of Maine Board of Visitors with us tonight, who I saw somewhere. She's right over here. Several representatives from the University of Maine Foundation, including the President Jeff Mills and members of his team, Sarah McPartland Good and Kevin Frazier. Thank you all. Past members of our board of directors for the Alumni Association, including Charles Stanhope, who is the current chair of the UMaine Honors College Board of Advocates and a past member of our board. Thank you for being here, Charles. And past chair of our board of directors, Julie Lindsay. Thank you for being here. And last but not least, the tremendous work from our University of Maine Alumni Association staff to pull this all together. Several members here, Ashley just snuck out, but Ashley Twombly, Chelsea McCallion, Mackenzie Staples, I got it right, she just got married, so I got the last name right. And where's Rebecca Huffstutler? She's here, she's out there, and Erica Wolf is here, so thank you all for your work. Through the University of Maine Foundation, a special fund was established to make sure that this annual program is accessible to all free of charge. Many thanks to those of you here today who have contributed to the Talbert Fund. Please refer to your program to learn more about making a designated gift to the Talbert Fund to support this and future events in the series. Next, while it's imprinted in your program as well, I would like to share with you the University of Maine Land Acknowledgement Statement at this time. The University of Maine recognizes that it is located on Marsh Island in the homeland of the Penobscot Nation, where issues of water and territorial rights and encroachment upon sacred sites are ongoing. Penobscot homeland is connected to the other Wabanaki tribal nations, the Passamaquoddy, Maliseet, and Mi'kmaq, through kinship, alliances, and diplomacy. The university also recognizes that the Penobscot Nation and the other Wabanaki tribal nations are distinct, sovereign, legal, and political entities with their own powers of self-governance and self-determination. It's now my pleasure to introduce Athena Bryce, who is the current president of the Greater Bangor Area Branch of the NAACP and a co-chair for tonight's event. Athena earned both bachelor's and master's degree in social work here at the University of Maine, a proud alum, and would like to offer a brief welcome on behalf of the NAACP. Athena.
Hello everyone, my name is Athena, and for the past year I have been honored to fill some really big shoes serving as the president of the Greater Bangor Area Branch of the NAACP. I'm really excited about tonight. It's my first time being here, and I'm excited about the conversations ahead, conversations that will really help strengthen political, social, educational, and economic equality for all people. This work is a collective effort, and your presence here is a powerful reminder of what community really is. So thank you for being here. The Greater Bangor Area Branch is really proud to collaborate with initiatives like this, the Robert Talbert Civil Rights Speaker Series, that's a mouthful, and other organizations that share our commitment towards justice, such as Juneteenth Downies, which uplifts and celebrates BIPOC communities statewide, and the Wabanaki Alliance. We stand firmly with the Wabanaki Alliance in supporting tribal nations of Maine as they seek dignity, sovereignty, and justice. Their resilience, their heritage, and leadership guide us towards a future rooted in respect and shared humanity. The pursuit of racial justice and environmental justice requires courage, though. Lots of resistance and really a lot of hope that there really is a better tomorrow, and it's possible. We are witnessing real and meaningful changes here in our state of Maine, in our small communities. Yet every step forward reveals really how much work we have going forward, which is why your involvement really matters, and it's so lovely to see you all here today. But it goes beyond tonight. Your voice, your energy, your perspectives, your unique life experiences and skills, it's all important towards the work for tomorrow. So we really want to encourage you and consider joining the NAACP branch and really becoming an active member. I want to encourage and invite you to think about joining the committee, volunteering at our community celebrations, offering your skills, attending some community events, and lending your voice to local and statewide policy initiatives. And there is a place for everyone at the branch and this movement and the work going forward. And really, no act is too small or not big enough. It really makes a difference, and no contribution really goes unnoticed. So again, thank you for all these powerhouses being in here and your fight for a better tomorrow.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Athena. I'd now like to turn our program over to the other co-chair of this event, John Diamond, who we introduced earlier. And as you heard, it's our president emeritus for the University of Maine Alumni Association, and a proud double alum with both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. So please welcome John Diamond.
Thanks so much, Tom, and thanks to Athena, and thank you all for being here for this special event, one we're all very proud of and particularly excited about tonight. I've had the honor and privilege of knowing tonight's speaker and respecting tonight's speaker for decades, and that's no understatement when I emphasize the respect I have for this person, Donna Loring. Your printed program has a short bio of Donna, so I'll avoid sharing with you what you've already read or will be reading, but I do want to add to that bio to make it clear, if it wasn't already, why Donna was selected to be this year's Robert Talbot speaker. Many successful difference makers have an inspiring backstory, and Donna's is a great example of that. Several of you know that Donna grew up living with her grandmother on Indian Island And in her late teens, she enlisted in the Women's Army Corps, the WACS, and served with distinction in Vietnam. That experience was the beginning of what has been 6 decades of commitment to public and community service, truth-telling, and advocacy. Donna graduated from the Maine Criminal Justice Academy and became the Academy's first female graduate to become a police chief in Maine. Later, she was elected to represent Penobscot Nation in the Maine legislature and served for 12 years. During that time, Donna worked closely with other legislators and state officials and greatly influenced public policies related to education, Native and civil rights, and much more during that period. And later she did the same as a formal advisor to Governor King and to Governor Mills. Public policy influencer has been just one of her roles, though, but all of them have been interrelated. She's used her considerable voice and literary talents to enlighten and advocate. In addition to publishing her memoir, In the Shadow of the Eagle, she also authored the play Mary and Molly. It's a story of a young Bangor woman who discovers her Penobscot ancestry and connects with her ancestor, Molly Molasses, to explore her identity, heritage, and belonging. And coincidentally, just yesterday, the animated film adaptation of Mary and Molly was screened and discussed here on campus at Fogler Library as part of Fogler's Salon series. There's so much more I could share about Donna's many accomplishments and awards, such as the fact that the University of New England named its own civil rights and social justice lecture after Donna. Let me wrap up this introduction by sharing the words of former UMaine President Sue Hunter when, in 2017, the University of Maine system conferred to Donna an honorary doctorate of humane letters. In her remarks at the time, President Hunter described Donna as, quote, someone whose vision, leadership, and outstanding contributions have made our world a better place. That short and sweet summation of Donna's influence and her commitment to public service, truth, and advocacy is spot on. Friends, please join me in welcoming to the podium the Honorable Donna Loring.
First of all, I promised my niece, Dr. Rebecca Sock-Basin, that she could say something. So I don't know what it's going to be, so I'm scared.
I wanted to, you know, in a tradition that is actually ancestral to the territory that we're on, we have a lot of old songs. And this is an honor song that I want to offer to my auntie. In our way, aunts are like our second mothers, and so this is actually a really beautiful intertribal. It's an old song called The Longest Walk. It's sung quite a bit in our Wabanaki communities, and it memorializes and honors the struggle of the people that came before us in order to be here today. And so I see, like, there's Nolan is out there. If you want to come up here and join me in singing this for my aunt, I would welcome you to do so. The Vice Chief, my brother, Mark Sock-Beeson, is here. And I would just invite you to, if you know the song, sing with us. And, you know, regardless, however you pray, someone before you prayed for your well-being. So this is, singing is praying for us. And this prayer that I offer to my aunt is to honor the work that she's doing, to honor the legacy that she will continue to leave, and honor her life. So here it is, okay?
Yeah.
That was unexpected. Believe me, I did not plan this. I'm honored, really, to be invited to this. I've known the Talbot family for over 30 years. I've known Rachel Talbot Ross for almost 30 years. And I met Rachel when I was the chief of security at Bowdoin College. And she came and wanted to speak to the security officers about multiculturalism. And I said, sure, why not? And then later, I think Tony Brinkley's here too. We all went on this mission and travel to Vietnam. Would be my second time in Vietnam. I served there in 1968, 69. So in 1995, Rachel was telling me that there was a business trip planned for Vietnam with the Francophone des Affaires, because I couldn't speak French. But everyone said it's okay. And I went, and in a way it was kind of scary, in another way it wasn't. I mean, when we landed in Vietnam, it was really hot. It's like walking out into a blanket of heat, like 110 degrees. So if I knew back then what I know now about our journey and how, you know, Rachel would end up being the first black speaker of the House, means that's huge in the state of Maine. And she's not here because she's traveling, but, you know, I was really, really proud that she is my friend. I'll say that to you. And that the And Bob Talbot, he's a great guy. So I'm really, really happy to be here at the lecture that's in his name. The other Talbot is the Honorable Gerald Talbot. And he actually made a path for all of us, for the tribes, actually, when he did Offensive Names Bill, that's it. He came up with the Offensive Names Bill. And we basically created a bill based on that, the S-word bill. And Donald Sauktoma sponsored that bill. So the Talbot family has done a lot in the state of Maine. And again, I'm really, really proud to be here at this lecture series. And thank you for inviting me to speak. As a Penobscot woman and a veteran, and someone who has spent much of her life inside the halls where Maine's laws are made, I've come to understand that history isn't just written in textbooks. It's written on paper that cuts both ways. The title of my lecture is Paper Chains. I use that phrase to describe how paper, laws, treaties, constitutions, and bureaucratic rules can bind people just as surely as iron shackles. Those papers of policy and law define who was free and who was not, who could own land and who could not, who was considered human in the eyes of the law and who was not. And I want to say right from the beginning that Maine owes its statehood to slaves and Indians. And I also want to say that what I'm going to say, I'm not making apologies for. And what I just said, Maine owes its statehood to slaves and Indians, that's not a figure of speech. It is a historic fact ignored for over 200 years. We might think of Maine as the moral North, the good part of America's story, the free state, the place that stood on the right side of history. But that image, that myth of innocence, hides a harder truth. The timber that built Maine's ships, the rum that filled its barrels, and the wealth that flowed through its ports, all connected directly to the global economy of slavery. Maine ship captains carried molasses from the Caribbean, lumber from our forests, and returned with rum, sugar, and profits built on the theft of tribal land resources and the labor of enslaved people. As Frederick Douglass once said of the North, quote, "They would not touch the slave whip, but they will build the ships to carry it," end of quote. So while Maine hands may not have held the lash, they built the handles for it. You tell yourselves you were different, that you stood on moral high ground, but Maine's prosperity was woven tightly into the same cloth of exploitation that clothed the entire nation. And while the black body was bound in chains of iron, the Wabanaki politic body of governments, our lands, and our right of self-rule were bound by chains of paper. To understand how Maine owes its existence to slaves and Indians, we must look at 1820. Maine's birth as a state was part of a political bargain, the Missouri Compromise. It was a deal struck between North and South to keep the fragile balance of power between slave and free states in the Union. Missouri entered as a slave state, Maine entered as a free state. Our freedom, our statehood, was made possible because another people's enslavement was allowed to continue. And buried in the Articles of Separation from Massachusetts was a single line that carried enormous consequence. It read that Maine would assume all the duties and obligations of Massachusetts with respect to the Indians. That sentence transferred centuries of treaty obligations, solemn promises made by Massachusetts to the Wabanaki Nations to the brand new state of Maine. But rather than honor those treaties, and those treaties were back in Watertown, 1775 forward, we have a number of treaties with Massachusetts that Maine agreed to accept that those obligations when they signed the 1820 treaty. But rather than honor those treaties, Maine reinterpreted them. The new state turned what had been nation-to-nation agreements into a paternal system of guardianship. We were no longer partners, we were wards. Maine officials acted as diplomats while negotiating the treaties. But once the treaty of 1820 was signed, we were reduced to wards. The state assumed the role of overseer. What should have been a document recognizing our sovereignty was, in the state's view, a declaration of surrender. From that moment, the state appointed Indian agents as overseers, forging the first heavy link in the paper chain that would bind us for generations. I know because I was brought up under the Indian agents, and I know that whenever we needed groceries or we needed heating oil or wood or anything, school shoes, we would have to go through the Indian agent and beg that agent for permission. And if the agent didn't like you, you wouldn't get it. And there were some, and in the Passamaquoddy I know, there were some who requested wood in the wintertime. And actually, this old, because I went through the papers, because the state had these boxes of letters from tribal members. And I came across this one letter from a Passamaquoddy woman. She was like 80 years old. And she said, I've asked the agent for oil and for heating wood, and he refuses to give that to me. I came across a note from George Stevens, who was the chief at that time to the state, saying that he named the person, so-and-so has asked you a number of times for food, grocery orders, and you refuse to grant them. And she goes, has to go from house to house to beg for food. So this agent situation was something that I don't think any of us or today can understand how humiliating that is and that was, and what kind of stamp that left on your self-image. The systems that controlled Black Native lives and Native lives were built from the same blueprint: domination disguised as law. Some laws are written to protect freedom, and others are written to define who does not deserve it. The U.S. Supreme Court once declared in Dred Scott v. Sanford that a Black man, and I quote, had no rights which a white man was bound to respect, end of quote. That was 1857, 30 years after we became a state. A case so morally bankrupt that had helped ignite the Civil War. It was later buried by the 14th Amendment, but its logic of exclusion deciding who counts and who's a person has never fully disappeared. Decades later, Plessy v. Ferguson legalized segregation under the fiction of separate but equal. That doctrine stood for nearly 60 years before Brown v. Board of Education struck it down. Both decisions are now condemned as bad law. Bad law. Examples of courts, how courts can codify. When we talk about bad law, we often think of Dred Scott and Plessy v. Ferguson. But Maine has its own Dred Scott moment. And it came in 1892 in the case called State v. Newell. Prejudice instead of justice. Here in Maine, we have our own versions of bad law, decisions that may not be taught in every classroom, but that have shaped the lives of Wabanaki people for generations. In Murch v. Toma, 1842, the Maine Supreme Judicial Court treated the tribes not as sovereign nations, but as wards of the state, a ruling that placed us under the thumb of state guardianship. 50 years later, in State v. Newell, 1892, the court ruled that a Passamaquoddy man could not exercise his treaty right to hunt because, in the court's words, the Indians are subject to the laws. The court cited Murch v. Toma as precedent. In this case, Passamaquoddy went hunting out of season to feed his own family and was arrested for hunting out of season. And in order to protect himself and to make an argument, he went back and had his attorneys gather all of the treaties between Massachusetts and Maine for this court case. This is, and again, it's a State v. Newell, remember that case. So, and Murch v. Toma was the precedent, and the tribal member was totally under the laws of the state, so that's what they found. Chief Justice Peters went on to decide that while they, the Indians, have partial organization for tenure of property and local affairs, they now have no separate political organization and are subject as individuals to all the laws of the state. He goes on, quote, as to the Treaty of 1780 and the other treaties, Justice Peters said, we do not find that the federal government ever by statute or treaty recognized these treaties. They are full of kindly assurances and protection, including hunting and fishing, but cannot be seriously claimed that they amount to a treaty between two political communities. However savage one of them may have been, they are now functus officio. One party of them, the Indians, have wholly lost their political organization, their political existence. There has been no continuity of succession of political life and power. There is no mention of the treaties of a tribe called the Passamaquoddy tribe. And we cannot say that these present Indians are the successors in territory or power of any tribe named in the treaties. They have for many years been without tribal organization, and while this decision is being said, we have tribal representatives sitting in the state legislature. They cannot make war or peace, cannot make treaties, cannot make laws, cannot punish crime, cannot administer even civil justice between himself and herself, their political civil rights can be administered only by the courts of the state, like all other inhabitants. The justices wrote that the tribes, tribal relations, have ceased to exist. This is State v. Noel, remember this, that we were now completely subject to the laws of the state. In that single sentence, the court did what centuries of war and disease had failed to do. It declared the Wabanaki people legally extinct. So when I talk about bad law, I am not speaking in the past tense. State v. Newell is still recognized in Maine law today. It is still treated as precedent. It is still quoted in opinions and state documents that presume the state's authority over tribal nations. In my mind, that case is just as bad as the previous cases that Plessy v. Ferguson and of Dred Scott. These decisions were not just on paper. They became the foundation for a century of laws that erased our sovereignty and justified state control over every aspect of our lives. For African Americans, the law denied personhood. For Wabanaki people, it denied nationhood. Both were stripped of the right to define themselves. Slavery was the bondage of bodies. Guardianship was the bondage of sovereignty, and both were justified on paper. While the South built Jim Crow to control the descendants of enslaved people, Maine built its own system of racial control for the Wabanaki, not through whips or chains, but through laws and ledgers. We didn't call it Jim Crow, we called it the Blue Book. It was a little blue covered volume published by the state of Maine each year, a tiny booklet that gathered every law relating to the Indians of Maine. Inside its pages were more links of the paper chain, rules that govern nearly every part of our lives, how we could govern ourselves, where we could hunt or fish, how our land could be used or sold, who controlled our money, and how our children were educated. It made sure that Wabanaki nations remained under guardianship, politically weak and economically dependent. The Blue Book was Maine's Jim Crow, a paper system of control that pretended to be benevolent. And then the thing about paper, it looks harmless, clean, orderly. But anyone who's ever had a paper cut knows its sting, sharp, sudden, and deep. The paper cuts of history are like that too. They don't bleed much at first, but they burn and sting for generations. Every treaty broken, every right denied, every law without our consent, each one of us has been cut. And over time, those cuts became scars on our collective memory. You see, the power of paper is that it hides its violence in tidy language, in official seals, a treaty, a deed, a law. They seem civilized, but they can wound as surely as any blade when written to subjugate. And yet, even with those paper chains, both black and indigenous peoples resisted. Freedom has always been our inheritance, and even when the law said otherwise. 1775, Chief Joseph Orono stood beside the revolutionaries and said to his warriors, quote, "We will stand on the same ground with them," meaning the revolutionaries, "for should he bind them in chains, next he will treat us as bears," end of quote. I was always been asked, why do Native people serve in the military? Why did you, you know, this kind of answers a lot of it, because what happens to the nation as a whole happens to us, but even worse. So when we're out there, we're really fighting to preserve our who we are. Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, Maliseet, and Mi'kmaq warriors fought in every war believing that service might bring respect, that loyalty might lead to recognition. Black soldiers fought in every war as well for the same recognition and respect. At the same time, black Mainers like Reuben Ruby founded the Abyssinian Meeting House in Portland, a beacon of self-determination and community. Families on Malaga Island tried to build a peaceful life, only to be uprooted and exiled by the same state that preached morality and progress. I've always felt that Malaga was a test. I think they wanted to test what would happen if they removed all these people from an island. When I was reading this history, when I first came across it, I thought, you know, it always seems to me that they were sort of using that as a test case. Maybe Indian Island would be next, or, you know, because I always felt it was a test. Our stories are braided together, each strand scarred by laws that spoke civilization while practicing exclusion. We survive by remembering who we are, even when the state refuses to recognize us. The past is not past. Those paper chains have not gone away. They continue to control us. They live in the Maine Indian Land Claims Settlement Act, where the word sovereignty was again redefined on paper. We're now looked at as being municipalities, subdivisions of the state. I could go way into that one, but I'm not gonna. They live in the ongoing debates of whether Wabanaki nations should have access to the same federal laws that protect every other tribe in the country. They live in the disparities of wealth, health, and justice that still mark all our communities, black and brown. Every generation of Mainers inherits that moral weight of those documents. The promise is broken and the truth's denied. But inheritance does not have to mean repetition. We can choose to rewrite those papers and those policies differently. We can choose to turn them from chains into covenants, truth, and equal justice. No people ever broke their chains alone, not the enslaved, not the dispossessed, not the silenced. Progress has always depended on allies, those willing to see the truth and act upon it, even when it's uncomfortable. White abolitionists stood with black freedom seekers to dismantle slavery. Courageous Mainers have stood beside tribes even today to fight for sovereignty and fairness. Educators and students continue to insist that Wabanaki studies be taught in every classroom. Brianna. So that truth becomes part of Maine's curriculum, not its secret. Allies are not saviors. They are witnesses who refuse to look away. They are neighbors who understand that justice is not a favor. It's a shared obligation. When we stand together, black, brown, and white, native and non-native, we begin to loosen the links forged by fear and ignorance. We begin to tell a new story for me, one where the measure of freedom is not who we exclude, but how deeply we connect. I carry with me the memory of my ancestors who signed those treaties, believing they were preserving their sovereignty. I carry the knowledge of the veterans, the mothers, the elders, and the youth who have held our nations together through centuries of erasure. And I carry hope, because I have seen what happens when people come together in truth. Maine's real story, the one not written in the textbooks, is a story of resilience and interdependence. This country's freedom was never an individual achievement. It has always been a collective one. So today, I invite you to join this work, to keep telling the truth, to keep teaching it, and to stand beside those who still fight for recognition, respect, and freedom, because the promise of Maine and of America is not fulfilled until all of her people are free. We are bound together by history, but also by possibility. And when we stand together, when we listen, remember, and act, those paper chains begin to fall away. It is imperative that we move forward together. United we stand, divided we fall. Those words are not just a motto. They are a moral compass for our shared future. And finally, I leave you with the words of Dr. Martin Luther King, who said, quote, "Keep your eyes on the prize," end of quote. He never said, "Eyes on the price." The difference between those two words is the difference between justice and greed, between community and self-interest, between bondage and freedom. Let us keep our eyes on the prize and walk forward, united, together. Thank you. I wanted to leave, but they wouldn't let me.
We wouldn't let them. No. We do have time for a couple of questions, so we have a microphone on each side. I did also want to acknowledge that Penobscot Nation Ambassador Molly Bryant has joined us. Thank you for being with us tonight. So appreciate
it. Let me just say that the Penobscot Nation Vice Chief is with us as well, Mark Sockbason.
Thank you. Question over there, Ashley. So,
I'm wondering what the status is.
Yeah, microphone.
I was wondering what the status is currently about Wabanaki courses and education in the school system in Maine. How widespread is it? Is it being effective?
Well, lots of people have been studying that very question. What I'm going to say is they're working on it. It's been like, 24 years since that law was on the books. And not every school has observed it. We knew at the time that not every school would. And my thought was, if it just reaches
one school, one student, and informs them about our history. It's worth it.
Is there a curriculum for it?
Yes, as far as I know, I think there are a number of curriculums, and we have the expert, the state expert, right here.
Did you want to?
Okay, just saying. Just believe me, because Indians don't lie.
Hi, Willa. I wonder if you could comment a bit on the mendacity involved in the way the state reads even the land claims. As I looked through that with some detail over the years, it's clear that what the tribe's argument is that what is not precluded as sovereignty remains sovereignty. The state claims that whatever, that sovereignty is only, that the rights are only as explicitly stated there, so that yes, certain rights are specified that go with municipalities, but there are a whole range of other rights that are not addressed and where sovereignty was never abrogated except that the state insisted on it, I believe.
Yeah, Tony, thanks for that. The state has never recognized federal law, federal Indian law. In fact, they make their own, like I said earlier. Federal Indian law requires that treaties and agreements be, if there's a question, be found in favor of the Indian side. I'm not an attorney, I'm just trying to put it as simply as I can, that, you know, Maine does not go by federal law, federal Indian law. They haven't since 1820, since they signed a treaty that they weren't supposed to sign, and was forbidden to sign in 1790. Anyway.
Well, I just mentioned that the people who helped on the state side negotiate the Indian Alliance claim, Jim Woodcock, agree with me that it has been radically misread by the state to use against the tribe rather than recognizing what it actually said.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? I don't care. That land claims, to me, is fruit of the poisonous tree and should be abrogated. We shouldn't be playing with it. Sorry.
Hi, Donna. Thank you so much for your words. I'm really going to be thinking about paper chains. And I'm thinking about how paper chains are made by people, and wondering if that fact gives you hope or despair.
Well, people make paper chains, yes, but people also can break them. And the only way that we can is, you know, is what I was saying, is we need to unify. And we do have allies that are helping us, helping the tribes break these chains. And unity is the answer on the local level, state, and even on the federal level. No, Margot.
Hi, Donna. I'm really struck by your reference to the bad law of state renewal. And it seems to me that, you know, now in the United States, if we have lawyers and judges who agree that Plessy versus Ferguson is bad law, that a chorus of judges and lawyers in Maine saying that about state renewal would go a long way. And I know that there are judges and there are lawyers in the state who believe that it is bad law. And I guess, you know, the question is, how do we find the opportunities for that to be articulated?
Well, it's precedent, and it's been used in modern cases to solidify Maine's position that tribes are not sovereign. And it is based on the state renewal decision, which is bad law. And there,
You know, like I said, I'm not an attorney, but I've been in legislature for quite a while. And I can't imagine that maybe a bill couldn't come forward that would get rid of that law. No, just a thought, just thinking out loud.
Any other questions before we wrap up? Okay. Donna Lauren, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for listening to Wabanaki Windows. I'm Donna Loring. Let's keep learning, keep questioning, and keep moving forward together. Until next time.